have brought the Word of God to humanity. Today, Islam and its followers are on the receiving end of some of the most vicious attacks, all for the appalling acts of a few.
It is quite overt, and the paradox that Muslims are often accused of terrorism, whereas they're in fact amongst the prime victims of terrorism, because they do get attacked by fanatics and extremists all the time.
Prophet Muhammad laid the foundation for the religion of Islam that after his death developed a culture and civilization that spread around the world, inspiring hundreds of millions.
At a time when many in the West, under the influence of the mainstream media, see Islam as a violent, intolerant faith, it is hoped that publications such as this one will shed light on true Islam and win hearts and minds. Saeed Purizab, London.
He is referred to as the head of ambassadors in Iran. Salah al-Zawawi has retired after completing his 40th year as the Palestinian ambassador to Iran. He finished his tenure in January when he was succeeded by his daughter, Salam al-Zawawi. Here at the Tehran office of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the former Palestinian envoy was honored for his four decades of activities. Following the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iran ended its alliance with Israel and officially recognized Palestine as a state. This was followed by shutting down the Israeli embassy in Tehran and turning it over to the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Al-Zawawi was among a delegation headed by then PLO chief Yasser Arafat, who came to Iran days after the revolution and symbolically took over the keys of the embassy. Al-Zawawi is one of the founding members of Fatah political party and the second Palestinian ambassador to Iran since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He has held the post since 1981, and before that, he served as the Palestinian ambassador to Algeria, Brazil, and Kenya. Throughout his career, Al-Zawawi took major steps to shed light on the Israeli occupation of Palestine, which has been ongoing for more than seven decades.
After four decades of serving as Palestine's envoy to Iran, Salah al-Zawawi is now retiring. But unlike any other ambassador, he's not going to live his retired life in his home country, as he's one of the millions of Palestinian diaspora who are denied the right to return to their homeland. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
If passed, the Borders and Nationality Bill will give the UK government the power to jail asylum seekers for up to 4 years if they arrive via sea routes like the English Channel, and others could be sent to a third country for processing and detention. The devolved nations Scotland and Wales have already rejected it as an anti-refugee bill, and people on the streets of London are demanding Westminster do the same.
They're putting legislation in protest in place so that they can put guns on our beaches. That's what they want to do, because the migrants that will be coming when the climate and the ecological emergency really begins to hit, we want to welcome and they want to keep out.
Britain's banks, its military, its companies across the world creating poverty, creating destruction and warfare, and when people try to flee from the consequences of that, Britain puts up fences, borders, guards to keep people out.
The bill also gives the government extraordinary powers when it comes to ethnic minorities in the UK. A proposed rule change quietly added to the bill will give the Home Secretary draconian powers over immigrants, first, second and third generation alike.
The fact of the matter is you can be born and bred legally in the UK, but if you have dual citizenship or can claim citizenship somewhere else, the British government might give itself permission to strip you of your British citizenship. In short, you're not British enough. You're a second-class citizen.
Once you are a citizen, you have the right to remain a citizen. I mean, there's many incidents. That young woman in Syria, that's such an important precedent. They groomed her. She should be brought home. She should be looked after. This is, in any other situation, this would be considered child abuse.
Shamima Begum was 15 years old when she left the UK for Syria, where she was absorbed by the Daesh terrorist group. As a second-generation Bangladeshi, she has been stripped of her citizenship and is still languishing in a Syrian refugee camp.
These are the most racist pieces of legislation we've seen in the UK in modern British history. They constitute a direct infringement on every minority's rights, giving the right for a politician to take away our citizenship and giving the government overwhelming power to decide immigration policy. We're resisting today, we'll resist tomorrow, and we invite the country to resist alongside us.
Under the new bill, the government would no longer have to inform someone they are about to lose their citizenship. This will make appealing the decision almost impossible. Rights groups say these measures are used mainly against British Muslims, but Black and Asian Britons also say they now live in fear. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Sunday, the 27th of February, has been described as a major turning point for the EU. Including fighter jets, the 27-country bloc is going to send deadly military hardware to Ukraine, which will be used against Russian forces.
For the first time ever, the European Union will finance the purchase and delivery of weapons and other equipment to a country that is under attack.
The EU has always labelled itself as a peace project. Analysts are now questioning this.
They release huge funds to buy these lethal weapons from their own industries and to supply belligerent groups to continue the conflict. I think it's absolutely shocking and it's funeral of the European project as such, because it's not more a project of peace.
Another package of sanctions against Russia and Belarus were agreed by EU foreign affairs ministers on Sunday. Some Russian banks are being blocked from the SWIFT financial payment system.
This degree of disconnection is carefully calibrated in order to create the maximum damage to the financial system of Russia.
EU airspace is being closed to all Russian aircraft, and Russian media outlets, including RT, are being banned from broadcasting in the 27-nation bloc. Also on Sunday, EU Home Affairs ministers met to discuss support for member states Poland, Slovakia, Hungary and Romania, which have witnessed flows of asylum seekers.
We have already seen more than 300,000 Ukrainians are fleeing the country, coming to the European Union.
Meanwhile, all eyes are now on the Kremlin to see how it might respond to this latest set of measures. The EU is clearly taking a calculated risk by providing deadly weapons to Ukraine. But could this lead to the crisis spiralling completely out of control? EU citizens will be hoping the risk has not been miscalculated by the bloc. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After months of suspension, Afghan public universities have reopened. We visited Kabul University and spoke with a number of teachers and students. They say they're happy returning to the campus and hope good educational days are ahead.
We are very happy that we have returned to university again. We have been away from our classes and lessons for almost 7 months. I was longing for this day so much. This new beginning and opportunity can motivate us and give more hope for the future.
It is a big day for the young generation. The opening of the doors of universities could open the doors of developments. I hope this process continues well. I urge the international community to help our higher education sector and poor families so that their sons and daughters can get education.
Male and female students are returning to Kabul University, but in different shifts. Moreover, new roles and change are brought by the new directors.
Actually, I witnessed a lot of changes in Kabul University. First, some departments in the fine art faculty like cinema, music, and theater are said to be cancelled. Secondly, students are obliged to change their outfits. Girls should come in the morning and boys in the afternoon. In addition, we didn't find most of our former teachers and there were new figures.
Some experts say it's not all about reopening, and there are many challenges left on the way of higher education in Afghanistan.
A huge number of our scholars, professors, and lecturers left our country during the government change. This has caused a significant loss in our higher education institutions. We need them back now. Furthermore, the Taliban government are going to make changes in universities' educational syllabuses and staff. It's uncertain where the Taliban are leading our higher education.
Like most public universities, Kabul University had closed in the immediate aftermath of the Taliban took over. Formerly, the university had remained shut for some months due to COVID-19 pandemic. The reopening of universities have brought hope to the younger generation in Afghanistan. The students here say this process must be supported in advance so that they can continue their education this year successfully. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Iran's parliament is reviewing the details of the budget bill for the next fiscal year, starting on March 21st. The government's proposed budget stands at roughly $148 billion, some 4% higher than last year's approved budget. Lawmakers have earlier approved the generalities of the budget bill, and it's been a week now since the thorough examination of the bill kicked off in parliament's open sessions.
The government's cap on next year's budget is roughly $148 billion. Out of this figure, $60 billion is allocated for the general budget and $88 billion is earmarked for government spending. Parliament is making some revisions, especially in national development projects and infrastructure. We increased the allocated budget in these areas.
This time, the budget's examination process took longer due to the fact that lawmakers want to be as meticulous as possible while evaluating the income and spending in the country.
While Iran and the P4 Plus One are engaged in tough negotiations in Vienna over the revival of the 2015 deal, President Ebrahim Raisi says the budget bill seeks to promote a resistance economy that would not need to wait for the removal of U.S. sanctions.
Parliament says the budget bill was drawn up based on a no-deal possibility in the Vienna talks and the continuation of U.S. sanctions on Iran.
The proposed budget expects the country's oil sales to reach 1.2 million barrels per day, with $60 a barrel, which would earn Iran some $14 billion in the fiscal year 2022-23. Lawmakers reset this figure to 1.4 million BPDs, with $70 a barrel. Any agreement in the ongoing Vienna talks will immediately push Iran's oil sales up by at least 500,000 BPDs as a result of the removal of U.S. oil embargoes on Iran. But lawmakers say they will not wait for the fate of the negotiations to finalize the budget bill, saying any extra petrodollar will be spent for the good of the people.
We cannot waste our time and wait if the U.S. removes the sanctions or not. So we set the budget based on a daily export of 1.4 million barrels of oil through direct or barter sales and based on assumptions that oil prices will hover around $70 when in fact the prices are reaching $100. Any extra oil income will be saved in a national development fund.
President Ebrahim Raisi submitted the budget bill to Parliament in mid-December last year when Parliament approved its general outlines. Lawmakers now have 3 weeks to go over the details and fix the shortcomings of the budget, to pass it into law before handing it to the higher legislative body, the Constitutional Council, for final approval. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
EU foreign affairs ministers held talks in Brussels to bolster the 27-nation bloc's second round of new sanctions against Russia over the Kremlin's military campaign in Ukraine.
Only leaders in the world who are sanctioned by the European Union, Assad from Syria, Lukashenko from Belarus, and now Putin from Russia.
Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has also been added to the sanctions list. The idea is to block banks in the EU from making funds available to the two key Russian figures. Earlier on Friday, EU leaders agreed sanctions on Russia's energy, aviation and financial sectors.
We're now targeting 70% of the Russian banking market, but also key state-owned companies, including the field of defence.
Outside the EU leaders' summit, union members staged a peace demonstration.
We don't think to have a war in Ukraine is a good thing for European workers and for Ukrainian workers. So we don't agree with the war.
Leaders from the 30-country NATO alliance held a summit on Friday. The big question is, could moves by the West stoke the flames and turn this crisis into a catastrophe?
NATO allies have and continue to provide support, military, but also different types of equipment to Ukraine.
US troops under the NATO flag have just arrived in Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania. Moscow had requested less provocation from NATO, but it appears those calls continue to fall on deaf ears. According to some analysts, one positive fallout from the crisis could be greater independence for the EU when it comes to foreign policy.
The point has been made, there will be a realisation in the coming months. It is dangerous and extremely costly economically to allow Washington dictate relations between neighbours on the other side of the Atlantic. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Afghans gathered to celebrate Eid al-Mabas, an important day in the history of Islam on which the Prophet Muhammad was chosen as God's final messenger and started his prophetic mission. Participants paid tribute to the Grand Prophet of Islam and congratulated Muslims around the globe on this holy occasion.
I congratulate all Muslims worldwide on the anniversary of the Grand Eid al-Mab'ath. Prophet Muhammad was appointed as a messenger to enlighten the world and instruct people how to live. He taught us not to accept slavery and live freely. Afghans have proved that if we follow Islam, no one can defeat us.
Prophet Muhammad as the final messenger of God has been the best role model for humankind. He had the best personality and attributes. Prophet Muhammad says that he was sent to teach moral virtues to humanity. He serves as a teacher and as a savior for all Muslims and humanity.
Addressing the ceremony, speakers also emphasized the need for Islamic unity among all Muslims. They said one of the messages of the Prophet of Islam was to fight oppression, injustice and devils.
We Muslim nations are obliged to follow Prophet Muhammad's path and study his teachings and thoughts. One of his messages to us is to get united. Second, he asks us to resist against devils, oppressors and arrogant powers. That is when we will succeed.
Tuesday marks the anniversary of the beginning of the prophetic mission of Muhammad Rasulullah. Eid al-Mabas is largely commemorated by the followers of Islam around the globe. As a Muslim nation, Afghans take this opportunity to strengthen the bonds of brotherhood and solidarity. They say the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was a messenger of kindness, peace and justice. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It's the sixth day of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Tit for tat measures underway while more Ukrainians are fleeing their country. Ukraine's president says defending the capital Kiev is his top priority, while Russia has promised to demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. Reacting to developments in Ukraine, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the conflict there is the result of U.S. and Western policies. He cited Ukrainian and former Afghan presidents complaining of Washington leaving them high and dry. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let's see who's joining us in this edition of the Spotlight. We'll have research fellow with Global Policy Institute, George Zamuela, joining us out of Budapest. Also with us will be independent international affairs analyst, Gilbert Doctorow from Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Ask George this question. George, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky tweeted a few days ago that his country was left alone by the U.S. and the EU. Why did they betray Zelensky after Russia attacked Ukraine?
Well, just before I attempt to answer that question, I want to congratulate Gilbert. He was on a few weeks ago with me, and he predicted that this would happen. And most analysts didn't. He did. Well, to answer your question, though, I think that Zelensky was allowed himself to be used by the United States as a battering ram against Russia. I think, unfortunately, that Ukraine was ill-served by the United States and its allies, and this was the inevitable outcome. There was any number of opportunities as the crisis became more intense, particularly when President Putin started speaking about the Russia's red lines. And it should have been clear to the leaders of the West, Macron, Biden, Blinken, and the Germans, that the Russians were serious. And all Zelensky really had to do was at least to make a show of going ahead and talking. They badly let him down. They didn't explain to him that Russia is very serious. Instead, they allowed Ukraine to posture and to make declarations, open declarations, that we're not even going to legitimize the leaders of the Donetsk and Luhansk republics, even though the Minsk agreement explicitly states that the implementation of it requires negotiations between Kiev and the representatives of the Donetsk and Luhansk. They didn't tell him this. They allowed him to shoot his mouth off in Munich about Ukraine becoming a nuclear power. And, as I say, they let him down very badly, and they let Ukraine down very badly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Gilbert, there are people who argue that Ukraine has fallen victim to the West policy, especially those of the U.S. And they argue that the crisis in Ukraine and the ensuing Russian war was instigated by Washington and its post-Cold War expansion of NATO toward Russian borders. What's your take? How do you see the West's role in the war in Ukraine?
Well, the United States, the foreign policy community in Washington, must be delighted that they have lured the Russian forces into a war with Ukraine, which Russia did not want. Mm-hmm. Back in December, Russia highlighted to Washington and to NATO its main concern, which was to sit down at a table and talk about changing the architecture of security in Europe, which for the last 25 years the Russians have found very unsatisfactory, discriminatory, and resulting in ever-increasing threats to their national security through the expansion of NATO to the east. So the NATO question was by itself the number one priority of Russia, and Ukraine was to a certain extent an exhibit A about what NATO was about, why NATO was a threat. Exhibit A has become the whole exhibit at the present, because the issue of Russian security has fallen by the wayside, which delights certainly the power elite in Washington. And yet that is not the case in the final analysis. In the final analysis, what is proceeding day by day in the Russian operations in Ukraine is an attempt to smash NATO to pieces. Because the credibility of NATO, the credibility of the United States, and its security umbrella to all of its charges in NATO is being put to the test. And so far, as your question indicated, the test is being failed by the United States. There was stated before the action began, and as a kind of bait to Russia to act, President Biden said that the United States would never send a soldier to fight to help Ukraine in any war with Russia. This was backed up by other NATO members, and it was perfectly clear that Ukraine was being set up for a disaster. But the United States had no interest in the welfare of Ukraine. That Ukraine is simply a tool that was being used to bait and, if they succeeded, to do great damage to Russian sovereignty and Russian national power.
I'm going to ask you a question about that, too. Okay. Now, let me ask George about British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's spokesman saying Monday that Western sanctions in retaliation for the invasion of Ukraine are designed to topple Russian President Vladimir Putin. Is the U.S. seeking regime change in Russia?
Yes. I think that's been a fairly explicit policy on the part of the U.S. They've been dreaming of a return to the Gorbachev-Yeltsin era, and they've been frustrated year after year by Putin. I mean, we know this from the Hillary Clinton time. You know, that was in 2011, that they were clearly organizing protests in Russia. They want Putin out. The problem, I think, is, and I think this is a serious one, which is that there's a increasingly a mood in the West for some kind of a confrontation with Russia. There doesn't seem to be any of the restraint that used to animate Western governments. I mean, when Eisenhower in 1956 over Hungary, Lyndon Johnson in 68 over Czechoslovakia, and then subsequently, which is there are certain red lines that you don't cross. And you don't even want to start going on that you're going to get into an armed conflict, because that's just going to escalate into a very dangerous area. And unfortunately, too many Western leaders, such as Boris Johnson and Liz Truss and others, are talking openly about getting into some kind of a shooting war with Russia. This is so reckless, so absolutely disastrous, because I think the mood in Russia right now is that war, I mean, among the policymakers, that war with the West is inevitable. It may come now, it may come in 2-3 years, but it is coming. And I think that's a...
Gilbert, we also have a group of analysts who believe that the long-term goal of the crisis in Ukraine is to weaken Russia as part of Washington's willingness and crave for a unipolar world. Do you agree with them?
Well, yes, to contain Russia and to keep it down, that is clearly the objective. At the same time, coming back to the sanctions that have been imposed, which really match what was called previously the nuclear option, that is, devastating sanctions in the economic sphere, I think that the problem is that in Washington and in Brussels, they really don't understand Russia. They have with Russia as it is, the analytic skills, the intellectual skills to deal with. The economic sanctions are very severe. I think Russia expects them to be, because this conflict will end soon. The threats to Russian security and the regime or the government in place is not in that area. The issue for Russia is the Western press has misunderstood totally, and so forth. The Russian concern, the nature of the war as a fratricidal war, as a kind of civil war between two peoples that have a common history and very close relations and great number of intermarriages. Whereas I'm speaking about the Russian and the Ukrainian peoples. Mm-hmm. And for Russia, they have to proceed. The Kremlin has to proceed very carefully in its military operation, not to present mass slaughter in the American way of war, but to do surgical strikes, to destroy military objects, and to destroy those most radical and elements of the fighting forces in Ukraine, namely these battalions like the Azov battalion that is now surrounded in the Mariupol region, and destroy them separately without taking on the ordinary soldiers, all of whom have mothers and girlfriends and perhaps even relatives in Russia, or not to mention without doing significant damage to civilian infrastructure and to civilian people. So the Russian operation is working under constraints that have nothing to do with what Mr. Macron said, thought he was imposing on Vladimir Putin when they had their telephone call 2 days ago. Mm. Russia is proceeding with supreme caution, and the operation is taking longer and is more difficult than the American way of war, which is to march through with shock and awe and kill everything on your path.
And they call it peripheral damage.
Collateral damage of hundreds of thousands of civilians.
Right.
Yes.
Now, George, Russia's war on Ukraine, many believe, has revealed glaring hypocrisies and racism that Western media and governments are fueling. Let me cite you an example that caused great anger, at least here in West Asia. Maybe you've seen that CBS News senior correspondent, Charlie Diagata. He was reporting from Ukrainian capital Kiev on Friday. He said, I'm quoting him, "This isn't a place, with all due respect, like Iraq or Afghanistan. It has seen conflict raging for decades. This is a relatively civilized, relatively European country." End of quote. So what is said is dehumanization of people of color and race and normalization of white supremacy, plain and simple, is it not?
Well, I think there is something of that. But, you know, you could also say that the dehumanization of Russians, and before that the dehumanization of Serbs, was nonetheless played an important role in Western thinking. There is clearly a feeling that the Slavs, such as Russians and such as Serbs, are, you know, you don't want to use the old German expression Untermenschen, but you know, that's more or less what they think. So that's why when you think of what Russia is doing today is basically much, much less destructive than what the United States did in Iraq, what the United States did in Afghanistan, what NATO did in Yugoslavia. I mean, we've had 5-6 days, and although the media are trying to whip up hysteria about the horrific civilian casualties, they don't have much to work with. And basically, there hasn't been anything of the scale of those U.S.-led operations that I refer to. So why is everyone so indignant? Well, because it's the Russians. Russians don't have the same rights and prerogatives as we Westerners do. When we do it, that's fine. But when they do it, it isn't. And that's, in the same thing goes by with all this a lot of heated talk about violations of international law. Well, the United States has been violating international law left, right, and center, yet never once has anyone tried to impose sanctions on the United States. Never once has the United States been banned from sporting competitions. Never once has the United States oligarchs or very rich people been subjected to sanctions. So there's a very much a different set of standards that apply to the Westerners and to Russians.
Right. Now, on that note, let me ask Gilbert this question. Gilbert, the U.S. and its allies wage unprovoked wars and invasions in several countries: Afghanistan, Iraq, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, Palestine, and Yemen. And this without any U.N. authorization. They killed many people. So are we witnessing a good war, bad war dichotomy here? I mean, how do you explain this hypocrisy?
Well, hypocrisy is the small change of diplomacy everywhere in the world. It has been and it will be. So I wouldn't be in a state of shock over the double standards. That's to be expected. And I don't think that in the Kremlin they are suffering too much from any of the sanctions. You'll notice that the Russians have not responded to these sanctions, other than the banning of airspace, right, where they responded at once, but to the nuclear option attacks on the central bank of Russia and so forth, they have so far done nothing. And that tells you that they don't believe that these sanctions will long endure, and that they have in reserve compensatory sanctions that they are ready to impose if necessary. But there are no rush to do that. Now, what am I talking about? We all know that BP has said it's going to divest its shares in Rosneft, which are about 20% of Rosneft and are worth at least 25 billion dollars. They will take a beating on that, take a terrible loss, because it's hard to think who exactly, other than the Chinese, are going to stand up and present them with a check to buy their shares. That is the least of it. In the Russians, if they want to respond in like, can confiscate all of European property in Russia, which far exceeds in value whatever is being frozen in Russian assets in the West. But the Russians haven't been in haste to use those countermeasures, because they don't believe that this hysteria that we see today will last beyond a couple of weeks, during which time the problems will be resolved, including the whole question of Europe giving a fast-track admittance to Ukraine. Fast-track normally would mean 18 months. Ukraine, as it presently looks, will be lucky to stay in one piece beyond 2 or 3 weeks, after which it will probably be divided, reluctantly divided, by Russia, in collaboration with local people who are willing to work in and lead the new states.
Yeah. George, did you hear Gilbert's prediction? We'll wait for another 2-3 weeks and see if that comes true, too. Okay, that was my last question, of course, but you just mentioned it now. Now, George, let's talk a little bit about the way European countries have been welcoming Ukrainians and fleeing the war in their country with open arms, which is, of course, a good thing. But they did not treat refugees from Middle East and Africa in, let's say, 2021. They were fleeing wars in their countries, and those wars were caused by the U.S. and NATO. They were responsible for that. Can you shed some light on this?
Well, I think it goes back to your earlier point about hypocrisy. And if you remember, a couple of months ago, we had another bout of hysteria about this was involved Poland and Belarus. And the Poles were absolutely beside themselves over the prospect of 3,000 refugees or migrants or whatever you will, coming across the border from Belarus, and the EU was indignant about it, and NATO, and everybody condemned Belarus, and of course by implication Russia, that these people were on the border, and in fact Poland unleashed a cold water hose. This was late November, so that's pretty nasty. And again, you know, everyone just blamed Belarus and Russia. So yes, there's very much double standards, and it's you know, even applies to Viktor Orban, you know, who's been the great champion in Europe of saying no to migrants. He apparently is welcoming migrants from Ukraine.
Okay, now Gilbert, we have only 30 seconds if you want to add to your comments, especially your prediction.
Well, it's very difficult to be wise. The situation on the ground changes. I believe that Mr. Putin and his immediate advisors are extremely flexible and have been revising and will continue to revise both strategy and tactics depending on what they see on the ground. And so for us on the sidelines as commentators, it is extremely difficult to predict with any degree of reliability what will happen 2 or 3 weeks from now. But there are just some indications, as I said, that a likely split up of the Ukraine supervised by the Russians is in the cards. Whether that happens will depend on the rulers in Kiev presently and how they react to the Russian advances.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this show. Let me thank our guests. We had Senior Research Fellow with Global Policy Institute, George Zamueli in Budapest, and Independent International Affairs Analyst, Gilbert Akhtar in Brussels. Japanese host, Petrus Najafin. I'll see you next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
A new statistical report on the Zionist regime's most recent assault on Gaza shows the unbearable price paid by Palestinians for the maintenance of a Jewish state in Palestine. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Maureen Claire Murphy, writer. This article is published under the heading Gaza Pays the Price for Jewish State in Palestine. This is the first part of this article. A new statistical report on the Zionist regime's most recent assault on Gaza shows the unbearable price paid by Palestinians for the maintenance of a Jewish state in Palestine. Authored by three Palestinian human rights organizations, including Al-Mizan, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, and Al-Haq, the report examines the full-scale military offensive endured by Gazans for 11 days in May last year. The extensive damage that the Zionist regime wrought on Gaza further compounded the long-lasting humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip after 14 years of intensified closure and economic blockade, a form of collective punishment prohibited under international law. The Zionist regime, meanwhile, closed its crossings with Gaza during the May escalation. Two children referred for medical treatment outside the coastal enclave died waiting for access, according to the human rights groups. A rigorous field survey by those groups found that 240 Palestinians were killed by the Zionist regime's occupation forces during the 11-day offensive. Of them, 151 were civilians and 89 belonged to armed groups, though 10 of the latter were not actively participating in hostilities when they were killed. Among the 151 civilians killed, 59 were children, 54 were men, and 38 were women. The vast majority, 111 people, were killed by weapons fired from the Zionist regime fire jets. Nearly half of the total 240 people killed in Gaza during the war, and all but one of the women killed, were at home at the time of the Zionist regime's strike that ended their lives. One-third of the total 240 people killed were engaged in military action at the time. The human rights groups note the large number of casualties compared to the short duration of the military operation and the overall number of civilians, including children and women, killed.
The use of overwhelming force against civilians is a key Israeli regime's military strategy. That strategy, the Zahiye Doctrine, is named for the Beirut suburb heavily bombarded by the Zionist regime in 2006, when it was roundly defeated by Hezbollah. By using indiscriminate and disproportionate force, the Zionist regime aims to restore deterrence and turn the targeted civilian population against the armed resistance, whether it be Hezbollah in Lebanon or Hamas in Gaza. In both places, the Zahiye Doctrine has failed to turn the people against the resistance, which has in both in Lebanon and Gaza increased its capacity and capabilities. During May last year, Palestinian unity across geographic and political divides galvanized in ways not seen in years and inspired renewed global solidarity. The May war began after the Zionist regime's police stormed Al-Aqsa Mosque while it was filled with worshippers, injuring hundreds. Tensions had been brewing in the city for weeks as the Zionist regime sought and continues to seek to expel Palestinian families from their homes in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and hand them over to Jewish settlers. Resistance groups in Gaza fired volleys of rockets towards Al-Quds that night after a warning from the leader of Hamas armed wing over attacks in the city went unheeded by the Zionist regime. The Zionist regime began striking northern Gaza, where at least 20 Palestinians, including 9 children, were killed on that first day. The 11-day escalation ended with no decisive Israeli regime defeat against the resistance in Gaza, an automatic victory for the latter in the context of anti-colonial guerrilla warfare. The Zahiye Doctrine hasn't achieved what the Zionist regime intends, though it has inflicted profound harm on targeted civilians. But so long as Palestinians rightly refuse to submit to the removal and replacement with foreign settlers, the Zionist regime as the colonizing power requires a horrendously violent policy like the Zahiye Doctrine. That was admitted by the Haifa University demographer Aaron Sofer, a close advisor to the late Israeli regime Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, ahead of the latter's unilateral withdrawal of settlers from Gaza in 2005 and tightened blockade on the territory 2 years later. Sofer anticipated that Palestinians in Gaza, isolated and closed off, and with little other means of leveraging pressure on the Zionist regime, would rely on firing projectiles to resist what has become a medieval siege. We will tell the Palestinians that if a single missile is fired over the fence, we will fire 10 in response, and women and children will be killed and houses will be destroyed, Sofer explained. Anticipating the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, Sofer added, the pressure at the border will be awful. It's going to be a terrible war. So, if we want to remain alive, we will have to kill and kill and kill. All day, every day. This violence is necessary to guarantee a Jewish Zionist regime with an overwhelming majority of Jews, as Sofer thought. That is the logic underlining the Zionist regime's violence last May, when War Minister Benny Gantz warned that no person, area, or neighborhood in Gaza is immune. And so, 14 families lost 3 or more members when the Zionist regime bombed their homes.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.